listening to IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped. Welcome to the reading for the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 9th. I'm Mel from Drake University. Here's our first story. Our Savior's Lutheran Church has expanded and reconfigured its food pantry to create more space for food storage and assembly of food packages. The space developed to the pantry is now one-third larger, according to Lauren Noss, volunteer at the pantry and co-founder of Story Street Pantry. With the approval of the church council, led by President Roger Carlin, a conference room was converted into a storage and assembly room, and a room across the hall was turned into a conference room, said Josh Wiesner, director of the Our Savior's Pantry and co-founder of Story Street Pantry. He does the ordering for both pantries. The expansion of the space was done to streamline the work at Our Savior's Lutheran Food Pantry, but it also allows Our Savior's, which is partnered with Story Street Pantry, to become the distribution center for the Story Street Pantry mobile pantry services, Noss said. The new Our Savior's food assembly room will allow volunteers, including some from Emmanuel Lutheran Church, to assemble delivery orders for more than 100 households without leaving the room to restock, saving much needed time. Before, we had to go to multiple places to get food for orders, and I was actually assembling in the hall. Food even had to be carried over from a double garage the church owns across the street, he said. It's still used for long-term storage of non-perishables. The reconfigured storage area will now be used to restock the mobile food pantry and reduce restocking time for volunteers, Noss said. That, in turn, will allow Storage Street Pantry to further expand its mobile pantry services, which he manages. Our Savior's Lutheran Food Pantry, taking on the responsibility of being the distribution center for Story Street Pantry, allowed us to partner in August 2021 with 5 low-income apartment complexes in Council Bluffs to deliver USDA food items to seniors and people living with disabilities. He said, We are in discussions to add more locations in the coming months. Pantry volunteers deliver food orders to residents at Regal Towers and Dudley Court in Council Bluffs once a week, and recently added delivery services at Maple Park Apartments, Plainsview, and North Tower, Noss said. Story Street already partners with Carter Lake Community Presbyterian Pantry at 3030 North 9th Street in Carter Lake, Riverside Food Pantry at 603 Pioneer Avenue in Oakland, and San Andreas Food Pantry at 4440 South 25th Street in Omaha. It provides mobile pantry services from 11:30 a.m. to 12:30 p.m. on the first Monday of each month at Westminster Presbyterian Church, 517 South 32nd Street, Council Bluffs, and from 1 to 3 p.m. on the second Saturday of each month at Friendship Pantry, 2616 Avenue, Council Bluffs. The expansion is part of the overall mission of Our Savior's Lutheran Food Pantry and Story Street Pantry to increase pantry services in the Council Bluffs, Omaha metro area, Noss said. The expansion and reconfiguration of the space will help to decrease the time volunteers spend assembling food orders and restocking, which it gives us more time to provide direct services. Noss warned the Reverend Celeste Waymere, pastor at Our Savior's, that she might return for vacation sometime and find boxes of food in her office, but she assured him that she would keep it locked. Story Street Pantry was founded in January 2020 by Noss and Wiesner. The organization is incorporated in Iowa and Nebraska and received 501c3 nonprofit status in September 2020. Story Street started the Carter Lake and San Andreas pantries and formed partnerships with the others. Story Street receives USDA DA farmers to families' food boxes monthly and also receives food from Food Bank for the Heartland, St. Patrick's Catholic Church, and local businesses and residents. The group also purchases food using grants and monetary donations from the public. Story Street first deployed the mobile pantry on July 5th, 2021, and has used it regularly since July. Next is a short story titled Bluffs Police Investigate Shooting at Area Motel. The Council Bluffs Police Department is investigating a shooting that occurred in the early morning hours Wednesday at an area motel. The department said officers were dispatched at 1:39 a.m. to the American Inn on South 24th Street, where they found a 40-year-old woman suffering from an apparent gunshot wound to the leg. Council Bluffs Fire Department medics took the woman to an area hospital for treatment. After further investigation, police said it appeared the suspect's vehicle was a newer silver four-door Hyundai Sonata. Officers were also told there were three Hispanic males and a female in the suspect vehicle at the time of the shooting. At this time, it is unknown if the victim knew the suspects, police said. It is also unknown where the suspects had gone after the incident. An investigation by the department's Criminal Investigation Division continues. Anyone with any information that was in the area at the time of the incident is encouraged to contact the division at 712-328-4728 or call Crime Stoppers at 712-328-7867. The next story is titled Reynolds Commits $100 million More to Overcoming the Housing Shortage. We must eliminate barriers to those trying to enter the workforce. This is a quote at the beginning of the article from Governor Reynolds. Cedar Rapids, speaking to Iowa's growing need for affordable housing to help meet workforce demands, Governor Kim Reynolds announced Wednesday that $100 million infusion to increase the state's housing stock and prevent Iowans' ability to live in or near the communities where they work. That allocation, made postable through the American Rescue Plan Pandemic Relief Act and local fiscal relief funds, will add to the $230 million over 5 years the Iowa legislature already passed earlier this year to help overcome the state's housing shortage. That legislation alone, Reynolds said, during the Housing Iowa Conference in Cedar Rapids, made the state a leader for passing one of the most ambitious plans for housing growth anywhere in the country. If this was all that we had done to jumpstart construction over the coming years, it would have already been historic, she said. But we didn't stop there. With Wednesday's announcement that she's committing another $100 million to housing from the Iowa's federal coronavirus relief funds, Reynolds said that Iowa now has designated $330 million over 5 years to overcoming Iowa's housing shortage. For Iowa to continue to thrive, we must eliminate barriers to those trying to enter the workforce, said Reynolds, referencing Iowa's worker and housing shortage interplay. The transformative investment promises to build approximately 36,000 new housing units statewide, with an average contribution per unit of more than $9,000. She said, this payment represents a much-needed down payment on Iowa's long-term prosperity. While Iowa today is in a strong economic position after the shock of 2020, Reynolds said, the state needs more high-quality, attainable housing if it's to keep up with its unemployment opportunities. Specifically, Iowa is expected to need another 47,000 homes by 2030, including 10,586 for Iowans earning $38,450 a year or less. We are doing everything we can to expedite that and not only retain but recruit more people to this great state, Reynolds said. And these families, many of whom will be attracted to our state by our economic growth, our low cost of living, and safe neighborhoods, they need to be able to live in communities where they work. Iowa might be nationally recognized for its employment opportunities, but, Reynolds warns, our housing shortage continues to represent a catch. We've seen a growing mismatch between where the job opportunities are thriving and where people can find affordable places to live, she said. In announcing Iowa's additional $100 million housing investment, Reynolds spelled out a method to its distribution. $45 million will go into the federal housing tax credit program, expected to move about 15 housing tax credit projects forward that otherwise couldn't proceed, according to Reynolds. Through that investment, the program is expected to create about 700 rental homes for Iowans. Eligible projects include those that applied for the 2021 Federal Housing Tax Credit Program award but didn't receive one. Projects will be prioritized based on scoring criteria and must be shovel-ready, according to the governor's office. $20 million will provide gap financing to existing workforce housing tax credit program projects to help with the rising costs of construction materials. These funds will help ensure that the existing workforce housing tax credit projects are able to be completed, expanding housing opportunities for Iowans, according to her office. $20 million will go toward the new downtown housing grant program aimed at supporting downtown revitalization projects through the creation of new housing opportunities in communities with populations of 30,000 or less. $10 million will help secure a larger pipeline of skilled workers and more opportunities for homebuyers seeking a property in their price range through the Homes for Iowa initiative. That public-private initiative trains offenders at the Newton Correctional Facility to building single-family homes. The investment, according to the governor, will help with material costs, creation of a permanent shop, and establish a moving equipment setup, allowing the program to scale production and training. $4 million will go to the Home Repair Block Grant Plot Program to help homeowners fund necessary housing repairs, as Iowa's housing stock of comparatively older than the rest of the country, with an average median home age of 50 years. And a final $1 million will go into a monthly home buyer down payment assistant pilot meant to break down barriers to home ownership for 200 eligible Iowa minority households needing help buying a home. The program, according to the governor, will provide a $5,000 down payment and closing cost grant when used in conjunction with an Iowa Finance Authority mortgage program. If successful, Reynolds said, those pilots could be rapidly expanded. Combined with our legislative appropriation, today's announcement represents far and away the most consequential household policy Iowa has ever implemented, Reynolds said. And I couldn't be more excited to see what you, the builders, the developers, the community leaders in our state do with it. Now, we'll read a report by Matthew Daly that solar power could power 40% of the U.S. by 2035. This story is paired with an image of Sugar Hill Solar Site, seen June 15th in Clifton Park, New York. It is a field with a row of solar panels on it in black and white. Solar energy has the potential to supply up to 40% of the nation's electricity within 15 years, a tenfold increase over current solar output, but one that would require massive changes
in U.S. policy and billions of dollars in federal investment to modernize the nation's electric grid, a new federal report says. The report by the Energy Department's Office of Energy Efficiency and Renewable Energy says the United States would need to quadruple its annual solar capacity and continue to increase it year by year as it shifts to renewable dominant grid in order to address the existential threat posed by climate change. The report, released Wednesday, is not intended as a policy statement of or administration goal, officials said. Instead, it is designed to guide and inspire the next decade of solar innovation by helping us answer questions like, how fast does solar need to increase capacity and to what level? Said Becca Jones Alberta, director of the Energy Department's Solar Energy Technologies Office. Energy Secretary Jennifer Granholm said in a statement that the study illuminates the fact that solar, the cheapest and fastest growing source of clean energy, could produce enough electricity to power all the homes in the U.S. by 2035 and employ as many as 1.5 million people in the process. The report comes after President Joe Biden declared climate change has become everybody's crisis. During a visit to neighborhoods flooded by the remnants of Hurricane Ida, Biden warned Tuesday that it's time for America to get serious about the code red danger posed by climate change or face increasing loss of life and property. We can't turn it back very much, but we can prevent it from getting worse, Biden said before touring a New Jersey neighborhood ravaged by severe flooding caused by Ida. We don't have any more time. The natural disaster has given Biden an opening to push Congress to approve his plan to spend $1 trillion to fortify infrastructure nationwide, including electrical grids, water, and sewer systems, to better defend against extreme weather. The legislation has cleared the Senate and awaits a House vote. The U.S. installed a record 15 gigawatts of solar generating capacity in 2020, and solar now represents just over 3% of the current electricity supply, the Energy Department said. The Solar Futures Study, prepared by DOE's National Renewable Energy Laboratory, shows that by 2035, the country would need to quadruple its yearly capacity additions and provide 1,000 gigawatts of power to a renewable dominant grid. By 2050, solar energy could provide 1,600 gigawatts on a zero-carbon grid, producing more electricity than consumed in all residential and commercial buildings in the country today, the report said. Decarbonizing the entire energy system could result in as much as 3,000 gigawatts of solar by 2050 due to increased electrification in the transportation, buildings, and industrial sectors, the report said. The report assumes that clean energy policies currently being debated in Congress will drive a 95% reduction from 2005 levels in the grid's carbon dioxide emission by 2035 and 100% reduction by 2050. But even without aggressive action from Congress, an outcome that is far from certain in an evenly divided House and Senate, initiated solar capacity still see a sevenfold increase by 2050 relative to 2005, the report said. The next article is the September 9th face of the day. Gracie Utz. Gracie Utz is having a busy but fun start to the school year. Utz, 12, is a Council Bluff native and a 7th grader at Heartland Christian School. She's been at Heartland Christian for the last 3 years after transferring over from Council Bluff Community School District Her mom, Jennifer, substitute teaches for the school, and her younger brother, Jacob, is a fifth grader there. Ut said it was an easy transition over to Heartland Christian a few years ago, and she feels like it's a second home for her. The people are like family here, she said. We're all a big community here in the school, and I really like all the sports and activities here for us. It's just a great place. Utz is keeping busy as the school year just started a few weeks back. She's also a volleyball player, so her falls are always action-packed. Utz loves playing sports, not only for the friends she made over the years, but also for the competition. She said she is looking forward to competing on a higher level when she moves on to high school in a couple of years. Utz also competes outside of school, but it's on four legs instead of two. She's an avid horseback rider who shows for the West Potawatomi County 4-H Horse Club and competes in Eastern and Western style equestrian events outside of 4-H. Utz lives out in the country and spends a lot of time taking care of her horses and training. When she isn't busy with her athletic and equestrian training, Utz said she enjoys relaxing and creating art. She also loves baking and is excited for the upcoming cooler weather so she can make plenty of fall treats in the oven. Another local news article is titled Southwest Iowa Art Tour Begins Next Weekend. Golden Hills Reforest Conservation and Development announced that its 8th annual Southwest Art Tour will run September 18th through 19th and will feature more than 70 artists. The tour will feature 15 gathering places across 11 towns: Avoca, Clarinda, Council Bluffs, Essex, Glenwood, Harlan, Macedonia, Malvern, Leola, Red Oak, and Villisca. This self-guided tour allows participants to begin and end where they would like, come and go from location to location at their leisure, and explore diverse art forms, including fiber art, sculpture, pottery, painting, metalwork, jewelry, glassware, and much more from over 70 artists, a press release said. Gathering places includes Council Bluffs at Pace Hoff Center, 1001 South 6th Street, Leola at Penny Visions Art Gallery, 510 Front Street, Avoca on Avoca Main Street, Avoca Fire Hall, 212 West Crocker, Harlan Brick Wall Gallery, 1010 6th Street, Macedonia, the Painted Camel Gallery at 320 Main Street, Glenwood, Mary Sneed's Fine Art and Custom Framing at 507 South Locust Street in Glenwood, Malvern, East Liberty Church, 30178 Hutchings Avenue, Colorado Art Studio, 202 East 5th Street, and Charles E. and Florence M. Locken Community Center at 613-21 315th Street in Red Oak at 518 North 4th Street, Villisca, Flag at the Bank, 400 South 3rd Avenue, Essex, Brenda Scott Studios, 1154 State Highway 48, Clarinda, Zanzibar Creations, 2161 Key Avenue. A sneak peek will be held on September 17th from 4 to 7 p.m., where attendees can spend a little extra time at gathering spaces in Clarinda, Essex, Macedonia, Malvern, Neola, Red Oak, and Villisca. The Southwest Iowa Art Tour began with the internet to not only bring awareness of the arts and artists, in rural Southwest Iowa, but also to help support economic reinvestment in our small towns through the arts, the release said. Remember that when you purchase an original piece of work from an artist, You are directly helping to make the arts a viable career choice in our area. And while you're at it, grab a shake from the local ice cream shop and a burger from your local cafe. This is a free event and location. Hours and location hours are 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. on September 18th and noon to 4 p.m. on September 19th. More information can be found at bit.ly/3bptow6. You are listening to the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 9th on IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and Print Handicapped in Des Moines. I'm Mel from Drake University. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about this or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. We will now read an article called Food for Thought, What to Eat to Protect and Bolster Your Brain and Memory Function. When it comes to memory power and concentration, food choices can make a difference. Most easily, you can support optimal cognitive function and improve the health of your blood vessels with the help of nutrient-dense, antioxidant-rich vegetables and fruits. Dietary patterns that contain plenty of whole or minimally processed fruit and vegetables are linked with a lower stroke risk. You can include other plant foods and fish, and limit your intake of saturated fats, trans fats, and added sugars to support your brain's abilities to remember, concentrate, make decisions, and engage in functions for daily living. The best brain foods provide the energy needed to focus and learn while helping to protect against brain diseases. Here are three nutritional components that have been linked with better brain health, plus some of the smartest food for your noggin. Number one, vitamins. Vitamin E, found in green leafy vegetables, is an antioxidant that has been linked to improve memory and cognitive performance. Vitamins B6, B12, and folate are linked with lower homocysteine levels, which are associated with a lower risk of cognitive decline and Alzheimer's disease. Number two, unsaturated fats. Unsaturated fats are considered healthier fats and may help protect and preserve your memory. Diets that contain plenty of these fats have been linked to lower rates of dementia and mild cognitive impairments. Two main types of unsaturated fats are monounsaturated and polyunsaturated. Foods with these fats support brain health, but should be consumed in moderation because they're high in calories. 3. Omega-3s. Omega-3 fatty acids are a type of polyunsaturated fat. They're associated with lowering blood pressure, raising HDL or good cholesterol, increasing memory quality, and reducing the risk of some neurological disorders. Omega-3s are found in cold water fatty fish, as well as plant-based sources like nuts and seeds. Next, we'll read through today's obituaries. The first one is Carol Louise Gergen. Carol Louise Gergen, age 86, passed away peacefully on Sunday, September 5th, 2021, at Homestead of Crestview in Wichita, Kansas. She was born October 13th, 1934, in Council Bluffs, Iowa. She married James Bernard Gergen of Dallas, South Dakota on June 9th, 1956. They had four children. She was preceded in death by her parents, husband James Gergen, daughter Gina Sandfill, son Jimmy Gergen. Carol was a homemaker who always had a fresh baked bread or warm cookies from the oven when the children arrived home from school. She attended all school events and holidays were very important times for the family to gather together. Christmas was always the favorite time of year, from decorating the tree attending midnight masses, and preparing the biggest family dinner of the year. In addition to her two daughters, Demi McClellan and Roxanna Smith, Carol is survived by 9 grandchildren and 6 great-grandchildren. We invite friends and family to celebrate Carol's life on Friday, September 10th at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring, Bayless Park Chapel at 2 p.m. Following the memorial service, there will be a private graveside service for family members only. Next is Thirza Harthay. Thirza Harthay, aged 95, passed away September 6th, 1924, or 1920. The next one is Thirza Harthay. Thirza Harthay, aged 95, passed away September 6th, 2021, at Mill Pond Retirement Community in Ankeny, Iowa. She was born in Glenwood, Iowa, on January 7th, 1926, to Alfred and Inez Mumea, who preceded her in death. Also preceding her in death were her husband Daryl in March 2006, her twin sister Mary in 1988, sister-in-law Darlene Owens and her husband Glenn, brothers-in-law Walden Harthay, Lowell Harthay, and his first wife Vivian, and their sons Dr. James Harthay and Tom Harthay, and Lowell's second wife Audrey Harthay. Survivors are our daughters Beverly Scoggins of San Antonio, Texas, son Keith Harthay of Ankeny, Iowa, 5 grandchildren, 6 great-grandchildren, numerous nieces and nephews, sister-in-law Ava Harthay. Visitation Friday, 5 to 7 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring Funeral Home. Funeral service Saturday at 10 a.m. at St. Paul Lutheran Church, 12 Park Street, Taynor, Iowa. Interment St. Paul Lutheran Church Cemetery. A light lunch will be provided in the St. Paul Church basement following interment. Memorials may be made to St. Paul Cemetery Fund, care of St. Paul Lutheran Church, or Mill Pond Retirement Community, 1201 Southeast Mill Pond Court, Ankeny, Iowa, 50021. Masks are encouraged at the visitation and the funeral. Joan May Daubert Lenihan. Joan May Daubert Lenihan, Dr. Joan, 88, of Council Bluffs, Iowa, passed away peacefully at St. Elizabeth Hospital in Lincoln, Nebraska on September 5th, 2021. Joan was born on January 12th, 1933, in Yulee, Nebraska, to the late Earl and Alice Rabe Daubert. Joan is survived by her RCCTD, retired choo-choo train driver, Thomas W. Lenihan, Big Daddy. Children Thomas E. Lenihan of Council Bluffs, Iowa, and wife Roberta Patricia E. Bennett of Hickman, Northeast, and partner Sherry Wilson, Renee J. Jackson of Melbourne, Australia, Dennis J. Lenihan of Supply, North Carolina, and wife Sabrina Ann A. Axford of Raleigh, North Carolina, and husband Bill Teresa L. Mann of Supply, North Carolina, and husband Larry. 8 grandchildren, 11 great-grandchildren, brother Don A. Daubert, also a host of caring nieces, nephews, and friends. She was preceded in death by her sister Marilyn Nusser, Bonita Robinson, and Bonnie Isk. Some of Joan's best stories of life included family, all the in-laws, and the outlaws. Joan moved to South Omaha when she was 8 years old and graduated from South High in 1950. She met Tom at the Maid Right in Council Bluffs, and over a year of courtship, they married on August 8, 1953. For most of their marriage, Tom and Joan lived on Pine Terrace Drive, where they built a loving, caring home full of laughter and fun, where friends and family were always welcome for a cold drink and a home-cooked meal or takeout from Pizza King. When Joan wasn't managing the house, taking care of the kids, dancing with Tom, hanging with her sorority sisters of Beta Sigma Phi, she could be found cross-stitching, tickling the ivories, or volunteering at Mercy Hospital. Along with her love for cooking and all things floral, she helped with the neighborhood garden and shared the bounty of the shucked corn and pickled cucumbers with friends and family each season. Tom and Joan took many trips together, including Seattle, Washington, D.C., Miami, North Carolina, and many weekend jaunts down to Kansas City to catch a Royals game. They enjoyed extended vacations after Tom retired and the kids were out of the house, finally. Tom and Joan would get in the Buick and travel to Laughlin, Nevada, where they would take in the scenery of the Colorado River and perhaps shake the hands of the one-armed bandits. Dr. Joan had a keen interest in all things medical, and considering her main source of information came from Who Am I? Answer, Your Kidney, section in the Reader's Digest. She had a fairly extensive body of knowledge of human ailments. Though she was never formally trained to be a physician, her calmness and good old-fashioned common-sense approach proved to be a major asset in nearly any medical crisis. Joan was loved by many and touched the lives around her with her sense of humor and caring ear. She will be missed by all those who knew and loved her. The recitation of the Rosary will be on Thursday, September 9th, 2021 at 5:30 p.m. at Cutler O'Neill Meyer Woodring, followed by a visitation from 6 to 8 p.m. Funeral services will be on Friday, September 10th at 11 a.m. at Corpus Christi Parish, Queen of Apostles Church. The family will host a luncheon and receive friends in the church hall following the graveside service at St. Joseph Cemetery. The family requests those who wish to express sympathy to consider making a donation to Queen of Apostles Church. Mary Abigail Abby Benning. Mary Abigail Benning, age 70, of Neola, passed away September 4, 2021 at Chicago Mercy Hospital. Abby was born June 27, 1951 in Council Bluffs to the late Marvin and Mary Margaret Bullard Swanson. She graduated from Neola Tri-Center High School in 1969. Abby worked for many years at Eddie's and Menards. She was a member of St. Patrick Catholic Church in Neola Lions Club and a founding member of Tri-Center Dollars for Scholars. In addition to her parents, Abby was preceded in death by her son, Eric Benning, and sister, Joanne Shrury. Abby is survived by her sons, Marvin and Benning of Charles City, Iowa, Travis, Jamie, Benning of Binkney, Iowa, Dustin, Benning of Blair, Nebraska, 9 grandchildren, 3 great-grandchildren, sisters, Betty George Ruckman of Harlan, Iowa, Colleen Lujan of The Colony, Texas, brother-in-law Richard Dick Shrury of Panama, Iowa, and many nieces and nephews. Visitation with the family Thursdays 5 to 7 p.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church, Neola. Mass of Christian burial Friday at 10:30 a.m. at St. Patrick Catholic Church, Neola. Interment, St. Patrick's Cemetery, with a lunch following at the parish hall. Memorials are suggested to Tri-Center Dollars for Scholars for St. Patrick Catholic Church. Actor Williams Omar on Wire, dead at 54. Actor Michael K. Williams, who, as the rogue robber of drug dealers Omar Little on The Wire, created one of the most beloved and endearing characters in a prime era of television, died Monday. Williams was found dead Monday afternoon by family members in his Brooklyn penthouse apartment New York City police said. He was 54. His death was being investigated as a possible drug overdose, the NYPD said. Little, a stick-up boy based on a real figure from Baltimore, was probably the most popular character among the devoted fans of The Wire. The HBO show that ran from 2002 to 2008 and is rewatched constantly on streaming services. Williams was also a ubiquitous character actor in other shows and films for more than two decades, creating another classic character as Chalky White in HBO's Boardwalk Empire from 2010 to 2014, and appearing in films The 12 Years a Slave and Assassin's Creed. He is up for an Emmy for his role in HBO's Lovecraft Country. A win at the September 19th ceremony would be his first in four nominations. As Little, he played a criminal with a strict moral code, known for taking advantage of a reputation for brutality that wasn't real. Williams, who worked in tiny TV roles as a backup dancer for hip-hop acts before landing the role, said that reputation started to stick to him in real life. "The character of Omar thrusted me into the limelight," he told Stephen Colbert on The Late Show in 2016. "I had very low self-esteem growing up, a high need to be accepted, a corny kid from the projects. So all of a sudden, I'm like, Omar, yo, I'm getting a little respect from people who probably would have took my lunch money as a kid." With smoke from a cigarette often wafting through the darkness, the character would whistle the melody known to the American children as "The Farmer in the Dell" and British children as "A Hunting We Will Go" to ominously announce his arrival. He delivered many of the show's most memorable lines, including "A man gotta have a code" and "All in the game, yo, all in the game." The character also broke TV ground as an openly gay man whose sexuality wasn't central to his role. Williams appeared in all five seasons of The Wire from 2002 to 2008, his character growing in prominence with each season. His Wire co-stars and many others paid him tribute Monday afternoon. "The depth of my love for this brother can only be matched by the depth of my pain learning of his loss," Wendell Pierce, who played Detective William Bunk Moreland and had many memorable scenes with Williams, said on Twitter. "An immensely talented man with the ability to give voice to the human condition, portraying the lives of those whose humanity is seldom elevated until he sings their truth," David Simon, who created the show and Williams' character, said on Twitter that he was too gutted right now to say all that ought to be said. "Michael was a fine man and a rare talent on our journey. On our journey together, he always deserved the best words. And today, those words won't come." Isaiah Whitlock Jr., who played crooked politician Clay Davis on The Wire, tweeted that Williams was one of the nicest brothers on the planet with the biggest heart, an amazing actor and soul. Williams was born in 1966 in Brooklyn, the son of a mother from Nassau, Bahamas, and a father from South Carolina. He was raised in the Vanderveer Projects in East Flatbush, Brooklyn, and went to George Westington Career and Technical Education School. Next, we will cover news in the sports section. This article is titled "Falcons Cross Country Win Invite." St. Albert boys win Trainor Invite, Lily takes first. St. Albert Jr. Colin Lilly won his third race in a row on Tuesday at the Trainor Invite after running 5 kilometers in 17 minutes and 34 seconds. Lilly was one of 6 Falcons to finish in the top 20. St. Albert scored 51 points as a team to beat Missouri Valley by 4. "Our boys' team kept it close," head coach Russ Sindeler said. "Hats off to Missouri Valley boys. They have a very good team, and they will continue to sharpen them as they continue to sharpen us. Our girls ran well. Tyler Tingley ran a very good race. Carly McKeever also ran a great race. Hayden Piskorski placed 8th, was a 1905. Adam Denny came 15th with a 2015. Owen Wise took 16th with a 2018. Alex Gast earned 18th with a 2036. Chase Morton finished in 20th with a 2058. Jacob Boswell came in 55th with a 2519. Nolan Smith earned 74th with a 2846. And Jackson Wigginton placed 78th with a 2921. Underwood's Bryce Pattern came in 2nd with a 1751. Blake Allen placed 27th with a 2128. Carter Forbush finished in 51st with a 2502. And Harrison Goering ran a 3205 for 82nd. Bryce Pattern ran a great race tonight, finishing 2nd. Head coach Eric Kyle said, Blake Allen also ran well. We had several kids not run tonight due to minor injuries that we are resting. Triner's Cole Dooley placed 3rd with 1810. Mason Yoakum earned 7th with an 1855. John Ross Biederman placed 12th with a 2001. Jack Carley came in 34th with a 2207. Miles Nichols took 36th with a 2241. Andrew Saar finished in 53rd with a 2509. Michael Korisic ran a 2521 for 56th place, and Michael Davis placed 62nd with a 2539. Heartland Christian's Nicholas Milner led the Eagles with a sixth place finish after running in 1853. Gavin Anderson came in 28th with a 2130. Max King took 43rd with a 2353. Brady Dingus earned 46th with a 2436. Elijah Lewis finished 65th with a 2606. Diego Huey earned 77th with a 2908. And Josiah Gray placed 84th with 33 minutes. AHSTW's Caleb Hatch came in 11th with 1948. Caden Garrity took 25th with a 2122. And Joseph Thornock placed 41st with a 2339. Tri-Center's Michael Denning took 17th with a 2023. Cole Meyer ran a 2109 for 21st. Kyle McDonald earned 22nd with a 2119. Christian Dyer placed 29th with a 2132. Drew Georges finished in 31st with a 2154. Simon Weirs placed 38th with a 2251. Matt Eikenberry finished 48th with a 2449. Matt Stowe placed 71st with a 2754. Archer Ellsworth finished in 75th with a 2847. Zach Plone ran a 3041 for 80th, and Hunter Smith placed in 88th with a 3534. Tri-Center also had success in the girls' race, finishing in 2nd place. Logan Magnolia won the race. Quincy Schneckloth placed 4th with a 2246. Kyla Corrin came in 11th with 2348. Jaden Frank finished in 12th with a 2356. Karis Cornyn earned 13th with a 2415. And Olivia Mattson took 22nd with a 2550. I'm very proud of the way the girls ran tonight, head coach Lexi Cochran said. Quincy got out early and raced very smart, while the next three formed their pack and stuck together the entire race. Then Olivia was right in the next group. It was so exciting to see them all so close together. We talked this summer about the power of a pack, and they're determined to accomplish things this season. St. Albert's Tyler Tingley came in 5th with a time of 22:51. Carly McKeever earned 8th with a 23:17. Brenna Smith ran a 24:56 for 17th. Mallory Daly placed 30th with a 27.13. Kristen Piskorski ran a 28.11 for 35th. Kennedy Sanchez placed 36th with a 28.17. Paige Sundberg finished in 43rd with a 30.25, and Ava Hughes finished in 49th with a 31.59. AHSTW's Kylie Knopp placed 10th with a 23.36. Ellie Peterson came in 24th with a 26.10. Ellie Langer earned 26th with a 26.15. Miranda Akers placed 42nd with a 29.47. Azzy Welsh ran a 39.32 for 56, and Caitlin Dills took 58 with a 43.15. Heartland Christian's Grace Steinmetz placed 15th with a 24.28, and Isabel Wilson took 46th with a 31.16. I'm proud of our team tonight, head coach Sarah Steinmetz said. It's our second year of cross country for the school, and we went out and scored points for the high school boys. I'm proud of how hard all of them go out and work. Tyner's Carissa Spanier led the Cardinals with a 19th place finish at the time of 25.08. Mira Dreyer placed 27th with a 26.20. Aiden White came in 28th with a 26.20. And Brooklyn Curran finished in 39th with a 29.15. Underwood's Phoebe Wilson took 31st with a 27.25. Jordan Reimer came in 37th with a 28.21. Vivian Myers placed 45th with a 30.31. And Josie Rosas placed 54th with a 33.23. And that brings us to the end of today's reading for the Council Bluffs Daily Nonpareil for September 9th, 2021. The Nonpareil can be heard each weekday at 3 p.m. IRIS volunteers love to hear from listeners. If you have any comments or questions about today's broadcast or any IRIS program, please call toll-free from anywhere in Iowa at 877-404-4747. I'm Mel from Drake University in Des Moines. Thank you for listening.
The People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. Flu season should be winding down, but the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention are warning about a second wave of influenza peaking in the southeastern U.S. Earlier this year, tests showed that the most common strain of flu virus was H1N1. Now, however, the H3N2 strain is becoming more common. That's the strain that caused such a terrible flu season last year. Both strains are covered in this year's flu vaccine, and experts report that the flu shot reduced the number of cases that needed medical attention by 47%. There is a new oral antiviral drug this year called Xofluza. One dose is all that's necessary to shorten the duration of influenza symptoms.
The first really new antidepressant recently won FDA approval for treatment-resistant depression. Esketamine nasal spray will be sold under the brand name Spravato. Physicians and patients have been eagerly awaiting the arrival of this new type of antidepressant. They may be shocked by the price. People starting on this medication will need twice-a-week dosing for the first month. The list price is roughly $600 to $900 per dose. That means the initial month could cost as much as $6,800. After that, people will require once-weekly or twice-monthly nasal spray administration. Those costs would range from $2,300 to $3,500. At the end of a year, Spravato could end up costing $45,000. Some insurance companies may balk at that expense.
For years, health experts have been telling people that exercise is critical for good health and that walking is great exercise. Dog ownership can contribute. People who walk their dogs regularly get more exercise than people without pets. A study published in JAMA Surgery highlighted a downside of this otherwise pleasant activity, however. Dog ownership has increased in the U.S. over the last decade, but so have broken bones among older people out walking their dogs. Such fractures doubled between 2004 and 2017, with the majority of broken bones in women. About half of the breaks were in arms, wrists, or fingers. The other fractures, unfortunately, were more concerning. About 17% of the broken bones were hips, a situation that can have serious negative consequences for a person's mobility or even survival. The scientists recommend obedience training for pets so that they don't tug at the leash suddenly and tip a person over. In addition, it makes sense to match the dog and its temperament to the strength of the owner.
Week after week, the FDA has announced recalls of contaminated blood pressure drugs called angiotensin receptor blockers, or ARBs. So many lots of valsartan, irbesartan, and losartan have been removed from the market that there are serious shortages. To cope with this growing problem, the FDA has expedited the review of additional ARB products. This week, the agency announced that it had approved a new generic valsartan from Alkem Laboratories in India. The FDA reports that its evaluation of Alkem's manufacturing process does not indicate a likelihood of contamination with nitrosamine carcinogens.
New technology that allows for non-invasive imaging of the retina may allow eye doctors to diagnose Alzheimer's disease. The retina is richly supplied with blood through a dense network of fine blood vessels. In Alzheimer's disease, however, this network thins and becomes more sparse. Possibly, this reflects what's happening elsewhere in the brain as well. The imaging is optical coherence tomography angiography. Researchers at the Duke Eye Center compared the retinas of 39 people with Alzheimer's disease to the retinas of 37 people with mild cognitive impairment and 133 people with healthy cognitive function. In addition to the loss of tiny blood vessels in the retina, a specific layer of the retina was thinner in people with Alzheimer's disease. These changes did not show up in people with mild cognitive impairment. This is the second time within the past few months we've heard about the possibility that optical coherence tomography angiography may offer an early diagnosis for Alzheimer's disease. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.